turn this on.
That's okay. What you could say.
Today is the 30th of June, 2014. We're at the Shrine of the Ages for the wreath laying in commemoration of the 1956 United Airlines Transworld Airlines disaster over Chewar Butte and Grand Canyon. Today in this interview we have
Raymond Cook
and his wife
Krista Cook
and their daughter
Kirsten Menegello
and her daughter, granddaughter
Lucy Menegello.
My name is Tom Martin, and begin this interview, as we were walking over here, Raymond, you told me something which I asked you. Say that again for the tape.
All right. I think that there is an absence of awareness, I guess, of the impact that a disaster has on families, and particularly a national disaster. The event happens, and there's a big hoopla about what occurred and the press. But the real tragedy to me is that ongoing, the number of people that are affected over time, and there is no counseling. It's forgotten, the event's forgotten pretty quickly, but the impact goes on with families, and I think it's just sad that people are unaware of the tremendous impact and how people are affected over time, and there is no recording of that. There is no history of what's occurred, and that's part of why I wanted to do this recording, because I want to share some of the impact it's had on our family and others. I remember I was 12 years old when my father was killed. I didn't think I would be affected emotionally today, but it grabs me, unfortunately. The memory of it, I'm fine. I'll start with that day. I was at a friend's house playing baseball, and he wanted to try a different experiment, and the experiment was to use a baseball bat to hit a basketball, of all things. And so he did it a few times, and he said, "You try it." So I grabbed a baseball bat and hit a basketball, and when I hit the basketball, the bat whacked back and hit me in the head and put a big knot on my head. And it was a Friday, and my dad was due back from a business trip that he'd volunteered to do, and he was going to change companies. He was going to be the vice president of a new company. He was an extremely successful chemical engineer. He had had dinner with Elroy Hirsch, who was a famous member of the Los Angeles Rams the night before. He boarded the aircraft. Anyway, I got home and it was a big to-do. There were neighbors over. The house was filled with people. It was probably 6 or 7 in the evening. And they said that my dad's plane was missing. And don't touch the telephone. They had the phone off the hook and they were talking to the United Airlines. And they didn't have any more information other than the plane was missing. Later, as the evening progressed, they were able to discover that another plane was missing, a TWA plane was missing as well. And there was some indication that they saw some wreckage that they think might have been the TWA aircraft, but they had no sighting of the United at all. And so we went to bed with the thought that of the unknown. I kind of knew in my mind that since a plane hadn't shown up that he probably had perished in the accident. The next day, I guess, and I don't remember exactly when, but the next day we were told that they had seen some wreckage from what appeared to be the United aircraft. They fully established the TWA aircraft. They had discovered that. They were in a very difficult places to get to, and it was not going to be easy to get to the remains, but they had done some flybys, and it didn't appear that anyone had survived. As the days progressed, the next couple of days, they realized they really couldn't get to the United Airlines wreckage. So they were going to bring in some Swiss climbers to try to access and get to the site to see if anyone had survived, perhaps. They got into the TWA and began to bring the remains out. And I kind of, that just kind of, this whole process went on for a week or so, and then the next thing I remember, they said that there was going to be a funeral out at the Grand Canyon, and that some of the remains weren't going to be identified, and it appeared that my father was not going to be part of that. My mother was on pins and needles, I guess. My grandparents came to visit and stay with us. Other relatives called, and I remember it was not established, obviously, that he was deceased. But eventually, after a few weeks, the United representative came to our home. It was in the morning, early in the morning. And it was my mother, my grandfather, my grandmother, and myself. And there were two men from United who came and told my mother that my father had perished in the accident, and they weren't able to identify his body, and that he would be buried in the Grand Canyon. And my mother just totally, utterly collapsed. It was a horrific thing to see somebody that devastated. She cursed my father for passing away and was stuck with three kids. My grandmother tried to console her, but she was unconsolable. So for the most of that day, she cried and sobbed and eventually got a grip. But it took quite a while, and I realized the impact on it had on her. And as I mentioned earlier, the impact is unknown, but what happened to her, within a year, she had a hysterectomy, and they thought it was caused by stress, that she couldn't deal with it. And so eventually, we flew out to the canyon. We actually flew to Denver. My grandmother and grandfather came out. I had an uncle, two uncles that also came out. And then we flew from Denver to Winslow, I believe, and then bused in from Winslow for the event. Today was kind of a reminder of that whole thing. The difference was there was more seating, obviously. There were some more flowers, and just like at our home the day after the accident, a lot of press. I mean, the day after the accident, I forgot to say this, that morning we got up and there were probably 100 to 150 people from the press on the front lawns and trucks and all that kind of good stuff. And my mother said, don't go outside, don't talk to them, nobody talk to them. And why, I don't know. But anyway, we had a family friend, forgot their name, Ruth Fosty. So my mother assigned her to talk to the press. Huge mistake. Ruth gave all totally false information. None of it was correct. Mm-hmm. And so that got into the press. And then my mother was irate with Ruth Fosty for giving false. She said, then nobody can talk to the press. So nobody talked to the press. And eventually, after about 3-4 days, they dwindled down to nothing and they were gone. But I do remember that part of it. But we came out to the canyon. And the same thing this morning, I remember you had the entrance to the cemetery and all the press was kept back away from the event because it was in Life magazine now. It was a big deal. you know, everybody in the United States knew about this accident. It was the largest aviation disaster in the country. And so it was, you couldn't run from it. I mean, everybody's in your face about it. You know, how do you feel? I remember I played Little League Baseball and standing out in, I was a pitcher and I didn't pitch. I played the outfield, I played left field, and just standing out in left field and just feeling this empty wrenching in my gut that I wouldn't see my dad again. And it hurt so bad. But I had to go on. And they said, you don't have to play. And I thought, well, you got to play. You can't stop life. You got to go on. So life went on. But we came out here, and that day of the cemetery, was hard because one of the women, I'm guessing one of the wives of one of the deceased, lost it. She couldn't stop sobbing and crying, and she jumped on the grave, and it was a mess. Of course, the press loved it because there was a big to-do about it, and it was hard for the rest of us because we tried to sit there quietly and just remember, and it was just this horrific scene. But we got through all of that, and it passed. We kept in touch with Paul Boyd, who is our representative from United Airlines. Wonderful fellow. Took great care of our family, making sure we came out to the event and got back home safely. And then he kept in touch with my mother and about possible litigation and stuff. And as it turned out, we sued United and TWA, and we had a trial. I'm guessing about a year and a half later, out in Los Angeles. Los Angeles Superior Court is interesting because our courtroom was right next to the divorce of Eddie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds. And their courtroom was right next to ours. So we had to talk about press and not escaping. Yeah, this big divorce deal. And here we are having this lawsuit over the deal. My mother hired her mother worked for Santa Fe Railway, and she was head of the Women's Railway Association. So we hired an attorney with the Railway Association who had some history of dealing with tragic events, but he also charged a discounted fee, half fee, to represent us in the lawsuit. We sued both United and TWA. And I remember meeting with him in Los Angeles several times, pre-trial. We were out there for a month before the trial began, I guess, kind of going over all the events, and they were bringing in experts and pilots and all this kind of stuff for the trial. And then the trial began, and of course we were told not to talk to the attorneys from United or TWA, even if you're in the bathroom. They may say hello, don't say hello back. Couldn't talk to them. It was kind of strange. At that time, all litigation fell in favor of, you know, the companies. There weren't people who sued for damages. It didn't happen. And if you did, you were an outcast. So it was kind of an odd deal. And then we got a judge who, for whatever reason, favored the airlines. And eventually, he was disbarred by the Supreme Court for his activities in this trial. They were so prejudicial. But as the trial wore on, I was supposed to testify. We didn't get to that point. We settled out of court. They settled for $100,000 net between TWA and United. And we went back home. And, it was behind us, and life goes on. But very shortly after that period of time, my mother realized she couldn't deal with three children. I had an older brother, David, and a younger sister, Susan. My brother was a year and a half older. My sister was 3 years younger than me. And my mother couldn't deal with three kids. It was too much. And she asked me early in one summer if I would be willing to go away to school. And I said, no, I don't want to go away to school. I said, why me? She said, well, Susan's in an odd grade, and David's about to go to college, and, you know, I just can't handle all three of your children. I said, okay. So I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, if that's what you really want, and that's your only way of surviving, then I'll go. So I went, we went and interviewed at Wayland Academy, which is probably the finest private school in the United States. Everybody's attends there is an oil baron, and everybody has a chauffeur with a Mercedes, and you can't just get in. So I went and interviewed and did get in. I attended there for a year and a half, and I hated it. I was first in my class. As a sophomore, I played starting quarterback for the football team, and the headmaster, Ray Patterson, eventually became the president of the Houston Rockets. And just to show the influence these people had, my basketball coach was Tom Nosalke. He's the only NBA coach to win Coach of the Year in the NBA and the ABA. And I think he still does commentary for Utah. So anyway, I knew all these famous people, and I could have stayed at that school and gone to MIT and done all kinds of things, but I realized I didn't want to. I didn't like the limelight. I couldn't get out of back in the limelight again, and I hated it, and I wanted to be an average person. I didn't want to live like that. So after a year and a half, my brother then was in college, and I was able to go back home and became basically an average student in a public school. But I carried at that point, I lost my family. I didn't have the interaction with my brother or sister that I once had. I felt like I was an outcast. They were strangers when I went back home. So at 12, basically, I lost my family. I didn't have a family. I was alone. And when I went back, I did everything. I cooked the food. If we had to tile the basement floor, I did it. We had to paint the garage, I did it. I did all the landscaping. I did everything. I was it. I was my own family. I took care of them. So my wife sometimes wonders, why don't you want to do this around the house or that around the house? I've done it. I had to do it. I had to do it to survive. So you grow up early, I guess, and I realize now I was scarred emotionally, and just always felt alone, and I've carried that all my life. I don't know, the next chapter, I guess, I remember we had a maid. I don't remember the maid's name, black woman. And she drank, and she used to steal my mother's liquor. And my mother caught her doing it. And Winnie was her name. And she eventually fired her because she was drinking. But I was fascinated with, why do you drink? So I started stealing some liquor when I was 13, 14 years old, little, not too much. And she told me how Winnie poured water in and to cover up the booze she drank. And then my mother started marking the bottles. It was just a whole game. But I had a few drinks, and I thought, that's not bad. Something to do. And it goes back to Wayland Academy. It was in Milwaukee, and we lived in Detroit. And I'd take a train from Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, where the school was located, down to Milwaukee, and then fly home. So taking the train down, there was a pretty blonde gal among three or four of us who would take the train down to Milwaukee, and she said, oh, want a drink? We always have a few drinks going down. So here I was, 14 years old. I got drunk. I was drunk. Got on the plane drunk, got sick on the plane. Anyway. But it intrigued me, the feeling of, sorry, Lucy, I'm telling you what not to do. It intrigued me, the feeling of escape, of the liquor. So I didn't do a lot of that, but as I went back to school, and I went now to Ferndale High School, I started in my junior year, somebody's got to get the beer for the guys or whatever, and we, play football on the weekends. And I looked older, so I'd get the beer and started drinking more in an early age. That was reinforced later in the Marine Corps, where everybody drinks. I think everybody's that's a Marine is basically drunk most of the time, and that's the manly, badass thing to do, which I did, and took me on the road to basically a semi-alcoholic one way or another, which I eventually realized. But nothing I was proud of, that's for sure. And it was just a way of getting through the day. It's that simple. I was lost. I started dating a girl in high school, and the only reason I dated her was she had a family. I didn't have a family. And so we kind of, quote, went together, but I didn't even like the girl. But I liked the fact that she had a couple of uncles that were a couple years older, but I could play golf with them, and she had a sister, and I knew her father was he was an engineer, and I could relate to that. So I felt like this is a family. But I still drank too much. And got out of the Marine Corps, but let me tell you about a Marine Corps experience that I relayed to somebody earlier. It's kind of odd, but originally, with this accident, they blamed an air controller at Needles, Arizona, and for the accident, they said it was his fault. And as it turns out, it wasn't, but they blamed him. I met his son in the Marine Corps. I was a navigator in the KC-130F, and he was a radio operator. His name was Jerry Gary. And we discussed the accident and his father's role in it, who was later cleared of any wrongdoing. But we had flights together and got to know each other. And one day I had a bunch of flights up to Japan and back, they're called shuttles, and we kept losing an outboard engine. And eventually I was able to get off the flight because I'd done my time for the day. And I remember throwing my headset against a locker saying I was glad to be off this flight because we kept losing this outboard engine, going off the edge of the runway, they're going to fix it, they didn't fix it. And, you know, it wears on you, not staying on a runway, especially when you're flying off of islands. It's dangerous stuff. So anyway, I got off that flight, and Jerry got on it as a radio operator. We flew down to Da Nang, Vietnam, and then up into Hong Kong, which was a normal run for us. And coming out of Hong Kong, it's an airstrip. At that time, it was just a strip in the middle of the bay, Hong Kong Bay. They tried to take off, they lost the outboard engine. The pilot said, I've got it. The head flight mechanic said, don't abort the flight. They didn't abort the flight. They got up to about 1,000 feet and then dumped it in the Hong Kong Bay. Jerry Gary died along with 51 other people. And that was tragic to me and kind of ironic and weird. So I still remember it. I've been to the wall in Vietnam, and Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C., and had the ability to touch his name. Hmm. And I lost other friends, but that was a unique story relative to this accident.
Raymond, how did this impact your mother then? She
became an alcoholic. Okay. She died at 51 in an automobile accident. She went over an embankment and died as an alcoholic. She never got over the accident. I had a brother, older brother, who shot himself drunk, became an alcoholic, and committed suicide, living with my wife and I. The only solace I have in my life, really, was my current wife. I met her when I was 25 years old and married, and she stuck with me through all these times. She's just been a solid source to me of peace, even though I've had some terrible days. And I drank until I was probably 40 years old, and I haven't drank since the last 30 years. I just don't drink because I know how disastrous it is. But as I said, I lost my family, but I think all of our family members lost our family. And that's the tragedy of it, and there's no way to explain it. We couldn't even talk about it. It was sad. You know, I haven't really talked about a lot of this, some of it, until today. One reason to do it, my wife lived it, unfortunately. Thank you for being there. But I'm sure my daughter, you know, I, having gone through all that stuff, I suffered from PTSD and got treatment from the VA eventually. And it helped a lot because it made me realize the emotional impact of the whole thing. But I felt bad for my daughters because I wasn't a father I should have been, and a lot of things I should have done differently because I drank too much and did the wrong things and didn't do the right things. But I can't change that. I was trying to survive my days. And it was hard. So that's most of it, I guess. I just feel bad for families. And I saw people today out there. And I didn't think they would be emotional, but they were emotional too. And I have to think in my mind, they have their stories, and they probably are going to be prettier than mine. And it's the way life is sometimes. But you just go on.
Can I add something right now to this interview? Ray, you've mentioned to me several times about dreams you've always had. Remember about your father? Maybe you just want to add that. I think it would be nice to the story.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. It's funny, from the time I, right after he passed away, for years, every day I would dream my father would walk out of the Grand Canyon, and he would come out sunburned and worn, and say, "I'm here." They didn't find me, but I've been here, and here I am. And I, for years, had that dream. But I often thought, I talked to my grandmother a little about this, his mother, but. I think it helped my belief in God, because I thought a lot of times I talked to my dad. And that helped me believe that there was more to this world than we know. And that gave me some comfort, I think, that it was okay. The only thing I felt bad about for my father, really, as a result of other accidents now, and they said at the time that he didn't suffer, that the impact probably, they had a big decompression, and they would have been knocked out in a matter of seconds and would have not known what happened to them. I don't believe that's true at all. I think he was very much aware, and they probably rode it right down to the right into the ground, and were very much aware of what's happening. And the reason I say that is, an example would be, recently there was a fellow that flew, jumped into a wheel well of an aircraft, and went from California to Hawaii in the wheel well at 35,000 feet and survived. So what that says to me, decompression, no decompression, at 21,000 feet, while you can't breathe very well, but you can have your senses about you. And my guess is, and I feel that the sadness I have is his terror and the terror of the other passengers, that, oh my God, it's over, and it's a hell of a way to fall 21,000 feet to your death. So I think they all died a terrible death, no matter what we're told. I think that, and I don't believe anything else other than that. So, but thanks for mentioning me, thinking of him, and I still think of him. Not as often. I didn't think today, I really did not think today I would get emotional. But
excuse me for laughing.
I didn't.
No,
I really
you
didn't.
Said the 50th was a very big
time.
Time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a very special. Yeah,
I thought I'd kind of put it behind me, and it wouldn't affect me. But when I saw other people affected, it kind of grabbed me. And while this is, I'm sure, boring to Lucy, but someday, 50 years from now, you'll remember this day when we aren't here. And
That's exactly right.
Right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So it'll be interesting to you, I think, 50 years, just like it is interesting for me sitting here today.
And what this brings closure for me is you're just suddenly realizing it wasn't just 128 individuals, but the impact was to mothers, to parents, to sons, to future family.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They traveled a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
The pain and suffering.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And as you pointed out, we were not good at addressing that in 1956. I think we're some better here today. I mean, today when there's an incident like this, the first responders have someone to talk to right away. Mm-hmm. The family, etc. You mentioned PTSD and the VA finally coming around to address this. Where in the past we just did not talk about it. And
there's one other thing that's always hidden in the back of my mind that I find that kind of gets to me a little bit, because my mother died broke. Which, quite frankly, pisses me off. Her family members took advantage of her, took the money, and she gave it to them. And they lied to her to get it, but it doesn't matter. But one of the things, the amount of money she got from the settlement was peanuts. And here's where it kind of makes me mad, because it affected my family and my children, is that, we sued the airlines, and my mother represented me as a child. I wasn't compensated for my family and my children, and I think that's wrong. That we shouldn't have the opportunity to go back to the airlines and seek damages that are even reasonably current today, to take care of our families, because supposedly that was going to take care of our families for the rest of our lives. It was a joke. It was peanuts. And anyway, I just want to go on a record that I find that's not fair. Wasn't fair. Anyway.
Yeah. No. I get a sense of injustice throughout this whole interview. The damage clearly destroyed your mother.
Yep.
Your brother.
Yep.
Me. As an impartial observer, I look at you. Well, the wonderful wife, your daughter's here, your granddaughter's here. You've done pretty good.
I was lucky. It's because of my wife. Nothing I've done, but it's all them. Thank you.
We love you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm lucky.
For what you did to sort this out, basically on your own.
Yep.
Until
Krista.
You had some help.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Interesting.
Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down today and let us know this. And I kind of like to leave this open-ended, meaning as you keep, this isn't the end of this. This is not, we're not stopping here, meaning life goes on. And as you keep processing this, and you keep thinking of things, you write this down and send it in to Kim Beeson. Do you have her email?
I do.
Okay. Because the museum collection, to have your story, clearly there was a whole series of events that happened and a whole series of events that should have happened that didn't.
Right.
As far as sorting this all out.
But thanks for the opportunity. I'm grateful for the chance to tell some about our family and our history and the event and how it affected us. So I'm grateful for that. It's cathartic in a way. I mean, to get,
it is.
Get it out, get rid of it. And so thanks.
Yeah, thank
I appreciate
you.
The opportunity.
No, I think you've done incredibly well, given what happened. And you're not alone. I mean, this is just in a couple minutes. I had talking with someone else. They were saying they were four. And things really changed. How old are you?
12.
So that's how old I was when he passed away.
So she goes away. And think about that. You just put this into perspective for you, right? When mom just disappears. That's what Remy had to deal with when dad disappeared. So you're just trying to put that into perspective. of what that means.
How your life changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. At the 50-year reunion, there was another family member, Sally, and I don't remember her last name, and her dad was on a TWA aircraft. And I asked her, we didn't get into this whole discussion, but I said, how was your family impacted? How was it, you know, I said it basically destroyed our family, and she said it destroyed ours as well. And that's what I was referring to walking over here, and initially what I said in this interview is I don't think people get it. I really don't. I think that there's a lot to do when an event happens or somebody passes away, but it's the long-lasting implication of that that really isn't documented. And it's the part that needs to be addressed somehow, and it's missed. More than anything, it's just missed, and that's the sad part.
And you're capturing that right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Or?
No. You did great, Raymond.
Yeah. One thing, well, I want to do this. Krista, how did that impact you? My wife, Krista.
Yes. Oh, let me start. I think from the beginning when I met Ray, he was a wonderful person. And then I think going through our early years of marriage with his drinking and all, and talking about the disaster that had happened in his life with his father passing in the air crash disaster, I think I got a better insight to more and more of what was going on in him. I never did it. But through the years, I think I could feel more of his pain and anguish. And just stuck by him. And we have a great family.
And Kirsten, I remember you telling me once, a lot of times on, and this is the type of thing that just, it's a dagger in my heart. But it's life. Krista would work on Saturdays at Mother's Bridal Salon, and I'd have to take care of the girls. And Kirsten said to me once, she said, Kim and I knew you hated taking care of us. Yeah. And it was such a struggle for me. It was just terrible.
You didn't know how to do it.
No, I didn't. But let me ask the question I asked your mom. Yeah. How did my behavior impact you as a child?
I mean, in countless ways. I don't want to make you feel bad about it now. At the time, you didn't know any better. I think for me,
I won't feel bad about it. You got to be real here.
Well, I know, but I've gone through my own counseling to kind of sort out my own childhood issues and recognizing and forgiving you for the fact that you went through what you did. And you, each of us, we only come to each situation with the tools we have available to us. So, you know, you weren't emotionally whole to be present to be a father. So I forgive you for that. I mean, it's just, you know, I feel like we've done that work to kind of make peace with what that was. But, you know, you weren't around a lot. And when you were, I think you always just seemed preoccupied with other things. And as a child, you take that as, well, the person doesn't love me or care about me. But as an adult, I see it for you were dealing with your own stuff.
Yep.
You know, so, I mean, yep. I get that. But emotionally, it feels different as a child. So, and then it was hard seeing Uncle Dave come and live with us, and then when he killed himself, that was a very traumatic night that I don't relive it, but I felt I have strong memories from that time when I was 8, so, you know.
And I'm, as your family's advocate, I'm going to jump in here and say, what you're telling me my father told me, meaning I didn't know how to raise kids, and he felt inadequate, so I think part of this maybe, I don't mean to be giving any excuses, but just being a father, what kind of training do we get with this? So I think you've done really well. I just want you to know.
The results are good.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, there's three other families. Did you want to settle?
We have another section right here. You can start right now.
But I have no idea what I'm doing.
Well, we're finishing.
Then let's... Well, wait. We'll wrap up and
we're about finished.
Yeah.
No, so. I don't want to shortchange you.
No, we're good. No. We're good.
I just want to thank you so very, very much.
No, thank you. My pleasure.
One of the things that you might want to do is stay close with Kim. I don't know if you can get over to the museum collection. She's got a couple of pieces of aircraft over there. I don't know if that's something you're interested in actually just touching.
I have. I've been to the, I've had the chance to go to the accident, the
Confluence.
Confluence.
To the site. Okay, great.
And have some pictures of that. So I've been actually with some of the wreckage.
Excellent.
So,
very thanks. Good. Very good. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks. And thank you for taking the time.
I'm going to stop this.